great sense of appreciation and certainly a strong feeling of regret, I wish to present to you again our guest speaker for yesterday and today. Regret due to the fact that you will not be with us anymore after this morning. I trust that you have learned and profited from the fresh insights, the refreshing views of Ms. Sergio. She is the first of our lecturers in our concert lecture series. We have appreciated her contributions, and we look forward to hearing her at this time as she speaks on the power of youth in world affairs. Ms. Sergio.
Thank you. Having been so highly critical of a great many things, I have had some among you ask me the question, what can I do, what can we do? And perhaps I think it's been in the minds of many who haven't asked it. I would like to try to share with you what I believe you can do. I think you have to take a look at the world as a whole and realize that in countries where there has been major revolutions in recent years, whether a revolution against a colonial power, even though it was not expressed with violence, there was no violence when a country such as Nigeria in the first place achieved its independence from Britain, or in many of these colonies, subsequently there have been revolutionary movements. But whether it was that kind of non-violent revolution that turned over, revolved the situation, or whether it was the kind of revolution that we have seen in Russia and China and so forth, a sociological or ideological revolution, in an enormous proportion of the world, there have been revolutionary movements in the last 50 years, and many of them concentrated in the last 15 or 20. Out of all of these movements, inevitably, has come a much younger generation. It's an interesting fact that when Mr. Kennedy rose to the presidency, where people abroad did not know him, it isn't as if he had been already a very well-known writer or traveler or person who had already made an international mark, as indeed he might have, but he wasn't. He was an unknown quantity. He was an exception in our whole pattern because, as a Roman Catholic, he had broken down that absurd and rather backward barrier of religious antagonism. But aside from that, he was a novelty. The idea of his youth, for the first time, the United States was turning to a man of the younger generation. Somehow or other, when you look back at the age of men who have risen to the presidency, they have done so always at the end of a very long life, which is not to say that the value of wisdom acquired through living is not primary or paramount. It is, as Mr. Kennedy himself demonstrated. But the appeal of a young man coming to power in this country was overwhelming because America is always associated with youth. It is, in political or historical terms, a young country. 200 years of not quite 200 years, is 20 more than about 10 more still to go before you get to 1976, let us say, if that is a starting date. This is nothing as compared to the history of countries such as France or Great Britain or any of the countries of Europe, and of course of countries such as India and China that count their background, their known background in thousands of years. Consequently, there is an association between youth and America. And this man was the first one who somehow came to the fore, speaking as a president must once he is elected for everyone, including those who might not have chosen him, as a young man, a much better image. Interestingly enough, I'm not saying that Mr. Johnson is not, relatively speaking, a youngish man. He is, because we have had presidents, Eisenhower for one, Mr. Truman for another, Mr. Roosevelt, were all much older people in the White House. But even he is past that 42, 43, 45 age mark. which enables people to look upon a man as young in the sense of a person coming to a political career. So that you have in all of these other countries much younger leadership. In the stage, in the settled countries such as England or France or Belgium or Holland or Austria, Italy, countries where you, or Germany, where there has been this dreadful parenthesis of dictatorship, but now they are back within the democratic pattern and have gone back to very much to tradition, you find much older men in power. It's an interesting fact, and I don't know what the answer is. But I suppose the answer is that where you have a revolution, which in the proper sense of the word means revolt, turn around, what was under comes up, not only in a violent way, as in the Soviet or the Chinese Revolution, where the people who were under, literally, as a class, the poor, the deprived, the destitute, the illiterate, come up and take power, the power of the proletariat, as the description of it is. Not only for that reason, but because these are new ideas that come up with the revolution. Whether you like them or not, or I like them, is not the point of discussion now. The revolution brings up new ideas, and it is much harder for older men to accept the new ideas. And when you have a leader, such as, for example, Lenin, who was a man rather well on in years and a great philosopher, a man of great distinction in his field, whatever you may think of his political persuasions, he brought with him younger men. And so you see today the Soviet Union, which is very conservative as a communist country, much more conservative than China or than some of the others, has middle-aged men. It's got did away with Khrushchev, who was getting old, and it's got younger men coming up. But the more you go towards the younger countries, the younger nations, in Poland you have some very young people. Under Tito in Yugoslavia you have very young people. You generally have the man who led the revolution 20 years ago has remained at the top, obviously, and so he is 20 years older. So this in some cases would make him 60 or 70. But underneath, younger people, and where the revolution has been strictly political in the sense of an uprising against colonialism, very, very young men, as the various leaders that you see in other parts of Africa and Asia. And you see that the revolution, for example, in Indonesia against Sukarno in Subandhu has brought to the top much younger people. I'm saying this because if one is going to offer some kind of ideological leadership, even though we may not go out into the field of other countries with it, unquestionably, the thinking in this country, the political thinking in this country, has an enormous influence. For example, if you continue to have extremely conservative, I would say isolationistly inclined men in some of the Senate and House committees who don't recognize that it is not by starving a person to death, therefore refusing them grants that will provide them with food, that you change their ideas, but that it is rather by enabling them to make progress that they come to appreciate the source of their progress. If you give to a country that is teetering on the verge of communism because there is not enough to eat and you need much closer organization when you are poor, because the communists, of course, are very strict, they organize and they divide and everybody gets a quarter of a loaf of bread and there's no discussion, but everybody has a quarter of a loaf and there cannot be anybody who has half a loaf. The communists are perfect at this. When you get to be very poor, this kind of organization is necessary. To deprive people of food, as we have done, for example, with China, while the Canadians, who are much more advanced and forward-looking than we are, have been selling them, to try to deprive them is to make them feel that democracy starves people with whose opinion they differ. Whereas you know that the essence of democracy is that you allow people to have different opinions. So we deny the very doctrine we preach when we stand up and say, he is a communist, I will starve him. It is the communist who by his own statement of his own policy should be saying, you are a Democrat, you believe in freedom, I will serve you. This would be perfectly reasonable, because they do not believe in allowing space for difference. But we do, and yet our attitude towards the major difference, which is communism, has been, on the part of some of the older men in our Senate and in our House, to starve the communists. Now, first of all, it's absurd, because anybody who dies after expressing an appealing idea becomes a martyr. If you want to push the thing to its highest point, you can take our Lord Jesus Christ. No more ignominious death should ever have been imposed upon anybody. It is the acme of ignominy, the lowest form of execution. And look what happened. Even among people who maintain that there was no resurrection, but who are nonetheless Christians, the idea has risen, has come to flourish. You don't kill an idea when you kill the man who holds it. If anything, you enhance the value of the idea, because you've made a martyr of the man. This is true with a good idea, as Christianity, or with a poor idea, as might be a communist martyr. Because for those who respect the communist leader, his idea is good, and you cannot change this evaluation of it, except by showing them a better idea. You don't show them a better idea by destroying their leader, as we have attempted to do. We have been behind a great many political assassinations, as you know, revolutions in Latin America. We frankly had to confess to them. We have done things which we would scream sky high if we caught some other nation doing them, but it is a known fact that we use this as policy, not only, but if we would starve the people who differ from us, this would only increase their attachment to their own idea. Whereas where we have finally understood, and it was really with Mr. Kennedy that this change came about, where we have begun to trade with the Soviet Union, we are now very eager to trade with Romania, Bulgaria, and other countries, the penetration of ideas through trade is perhaps the most effective of all. And so, A, you permit these people who otherwise would have no contact with a different idea to have this contact, and B, if through your aid or your trade they achieve a better level of living, they will be inclined to look upon you with interest, if not with gratitude, and turn perhaps sufficiently away from their own way of life to examine yours. We need people who understand this at some of the top-level policy-making posts. And it is only the younger generation that can understand this. I feel very deeply for some of the young people who have gone out and rebelled against fighting in Vietnam, believing truly that this was what was meant by a free society. I feel deeply for them, first of all, because I feel for those who honestly, truly and sincerely, not because they were cowards and wanted to get out of it, and there were a few of those also, and they should have been sent to the front line, but I mean those who profoundly and deeply feel that there is a matter of conscience here, either religious conscience that you must not kill, or conscience politically that we are not helping the cause of the Vietnamese by continuing this war. Some people feel that way and have thought it over. I feel deeply for young people who have accepted the statement that this is a free society where difference of opinion freely expressed is accepted, who then have found themselves branded as communists when they were not communists any more than you are. Now, this is a tragedy that has happened in this country, that some of the older men, because it's not been young men, but older men, frightened by what democracy can do, because democracy is a much more difficult operation to handle than dictatorship. In a dictatorship, everybody obeys. The few who don't know very well what awaits them. Consequently, it is much easier to handle a restrained, militarized society. That's the whole trick of it. Most leaders like to do this. And this is what some of our own leaders would like to do, to have us all think exactly alike. Then what is the difference, I ask you? Except that in a communist society, you can't get out of it. It's not the fault of the people that they find themselves in this situation. And you cannot blame people for not wanting to run headlong into the arms of death by rebelling. But in this country, when you cannot open your mouth against something that the government or the military wants without being accused of being a communist and ostracized and ridiculed and punished for your attachment to your right to express your opinion by being sent into the front line when perhaps for other reasons you were not ready to go. This, my friend, is a shocking proposition, and I have heard this very severely criticized by other free countries. Either we are going to give people the freedom to differ, and we will train ourselves as to how to handle it. And this is where the success of democracy lies, in knowing how to keep unity without compulsion, in knowing how to keep homogeneity without suppressing the differences. Anybody can make a composite picture held together by force. It's no trick at all. It's to be able to allow people their differences and yet keep them united on the major issues. This is the whole strength. Remember that this country doesn't have a great history of staying united. In the modern world, we're the only country that really fought a major civil war over an issue of secession. And it took a war and death and destruction and all that you know that happened in order to keep this country united. So that we do not have a history of knowing how to handle the democratic principle of difference in a way different from that of the dictators. And when we didn't like the way the Indians behaved, look at what we did to them. You think anybody has forgotten that? We may have, but not a person abroad has. And we don't like the way some of the Negroes behave, and look at that. So that we don't have a very good history of how you handle the essence of democracy, which is to allow people to be different, but persuade them to remain united in the major issues. And consequently, today we need in the younger generation people who have understood these disasters, and while not abandoning their country, as many are doing, you know that the outflow of Americans going to live abroad is enormous, who are so sick by our betrayal in public of our own principles. I don't think this is what one should do. I think one stays and one accepts the hardship of trying to make the principle prevail. And I think it is the excess of older people at all levels of government which has prevailed up to now. Men in the House and in the Senate who were hitting 80 and 90. I think these are admirable people. And to go back to Mr. Kennedy, it's an interesting fact that he never made a major decision, including his decision of sending the first troops to Vietnam, because that's where it goes back to, without consulting Mr. Hoover, Mr. Truman, Mr. Eisenhower. He always consulted these older men, because they had found themselves in his identical predicament in one way or another, of being the one who alone had the responsibility, the obligation of making the final decision. And since he was a man with a very profound conscience, he felt that the advice of the young men around him, who reflected the trend of the times, scientists and people who had an enormous fund of knowledge, was only part of what he needed. He needed also that irreplaceable fact which is the wisdom born of experience. Yes, it looked as if it were going to work out like this on paper, but look, I lived through it, can say Eisenhower or Truman or Hoover. And in the end, this is what happened. Here is what I think. So that it is not to say that one discards the older people. And here again is something that we are falling for. We have tended where we want to put young people to the fore to eliminate the old from our society. This too is an extremely undemocratic and wrong affair, because we don't have the benefit of their counsel, and we are renouncing one of the basic responsibilities of life. When I am a child, I take from you, my parents, not only my nourishment, but everything else that comes to you. When you are old and can no longer provide for yourself, it is a responsibility to provide for them. And we have thrown this out on the shoulders of the government. We have Medicare because the people who are earning money don't want to put up money for the older people to go to hospitals. Remember that if we are moving and have moved into a tremendous area of socialism, and there is more socialism here than in Sweden, where socialism is officially the definition of the government, be it nonetheless a monarchy. It has been because the people have renounced their responsibility. We don't want to see the old dying of starvation in the street, as one has seen them sometimes in overcrowded countries where they die of leprosy, as in the Far East. It's a horrible sight. I don't know what is worse, to see a child die of hunger or a very, very old person. We don't want to see this, but we don't want to do anything to prevent it either. So let the government tax everybody. Let the government take over. When we don't want to work, let the government pay for unemployment. There are thousands of people in this country who, when they can no longer keep their job because the job itself disappears in the changing pattern of the time, do not want to take another job they are fit to take. There are many who have been made unfit for jobs, as in West Virginia coal mining areas. They cannot take modern jobs because their hands are ruined by their previous skills. They should get help. They should not be punished for the hard work they've done. But there are many in the younger generation who, when they leave a job or lose a job, use the 7 or 18 or however many weeks of unemployment there are, then they're obliged at the end of that time to take any job. They take it for 1 week, and then they go back on a sort of dole. And nobody objects to this. The people talk about it, but they do nothing. They don't offer retraining programs. They don't prepare people. And as for the aged, and for the retarded, and for the sick, we are letting the government do it all. And then we complain that the government is doing it, and that this is socialism. How many students there are who are on government scholarships who think that they can sit down? Look at all the institutes of learning who turn to the government for money because private individuals are now putting their money in paying investments, with the exception of very few foundations. Everybody wants a college education. Not everybody can pay for it. Let the government pay for it. Fine. But then don't complain if you have government control. Can't have it both ways. It's a decision that your generation is going to have to make. It's too late for the older generation. And that decision has to be made in two places. In society itself, in the community in which you live, whether your community is now a college or a university or a school of any kind, or whether the community in which you live is already the community in which you are building up a family. It's got to be made in that community by you as people, whether you are going to put up with certain hardships and not have 2 television sets and not have 2 cars, but have a woman in the house who isn't out working and who will raise your children, so that those children will come up healthy and you won't have to send them to a government-sponsored psychiatric clinic. You've got to make that decision. And the decision has to be made at the highest point of all, in the House and in the Senate, both at state and at federal level, as to how much of this legislation is going to be passed. But as to how much aid, how much of the solution to these problems is going to be given by the people. And unless you've got people at the top who can think through who can inspire the population to take on some of these problems. The people complain about higher taxes, but they don't want to take on the problem that the tax money is solving. So you need people at the top who can go to the population and say it is not what the country can do for you, but what you can do for the country that matters. And nobody has said that to us for a long time. And unless this change of values comes from your generation, my friends, you are not going to have a country. This is a terrible statement to make, but I'm conscious of what I'm saying. Because the decline in this country of values, of discipline, of respect, of regard from everything, beginning with Almighty God and ending up with animals in the street, is appalling. What can you do? I think there are many things that you can do, and I think that one of the great positive factors in this country, which very few other countries have, is that we are a country that does not think deeply, and therefore, as a whole, we accept statements so that you can change public opinion very quickly. You can generate a very bad wave, and you can generate a good one that sweeps it away with almost the same amount of speed. I will never forget, because I lived through these two experiences, the March on Washington, organized to bring about equal rights, and the funeral of Mr. Kennedy. In both of these events, I was somewhat involved for different reasons. I was chairman of all the women of all the churches of Washington at the time of the march. People of all denominations and all races and colors and of all nationalities, because many people from the embassies came to help us. We ran the great press, television, and radio pavilion and handled the foreign press. I might tell you in parenthesis this, which shocked me. I hope it shocks you. When the march was, we were a week before the march, the Department of State called up and said, can you make provisions for the television crews to come to televise the march from 9 different countries? Now, whenever we have a major event in this country, that was a very unusual event, I grant you, but we have had major events, the television companies of other countries, whether they are government-controlled or private, makes no difference, take the picture from us. They employ NBC or CBS or ABC to be at their service and to transmit to them all of their pictures. Sometimes they use their own commentators and reporters who are here to do the commentary so that it is better tied in with the country to which it is going, more related to it, but they always take the picture. This time, they were sending all their camera crews at fantastic expense. When we investigated, we discovered that the attitude was, the Americans are so violently racist and so unfair that in that march they will only tend to show the worst that is happening and not the best. Therefore, we are sending our own crews. Believe me, you, this gave us a shock that we had this reputation. The crews all came, and I'm glad they came because they saw that what they believed was not right. Everybody was swept up in the extraordinary experience of that march. It was one of the most extraordinary things I have ever lived through. In the city of Washington, which is not known for its lack of crime, I would say, ordinarily, I think that everybody was out in the streets. Every policeman plus 5,000 young men and young women of all races who had been trained as marshals, not bearing weapons, but trained to be in the crowd in case trouble occurred, a person was taken ill, anything can happen, anything. They were trained, plus those. Everybody was where the march was. The city was otherwise abandoned. There was not one theft of one car, not one assault on one person, not one breaking into a bank, not one holdup, not one thing happened in that city. Why? Because suddenly the meaning of this occurring at the foot of the Lincoln Monument touched something in people. And overnight, this great wave of cooperation occurred. The foreign press, as they came to thank us in the pavilion at the end of the day, tired as they were, said this was a fantastic experience. We didn't need to come, but we are glad we came, because we saw what the American people can do when the right chord is touched. Again, for Mr. Kennedy's funeral, the town was abandoned. Everybody was on the line of march of that funeral. Every policeman was out. We had here the heads of state, 40, 50 countries, walking down Connecticut Avenue, unbeknownst to anybody, unprepared. There wasn't a single policeman on any roof to watch when they started marching out of the White House down that open avenue. So you can imagine what could have happened. Unbelievable. People shudder in the police when they think. So you can imagine what could have happened. Unbelievable. People shudder in the police when they think of what could have happened. Not one crime again that day. Not a car stolen, not a bank held up, not a woman assaulted, nothing. Nothing. And this held over. And people marched up to that cemetery in the mud, and in the cold, and in the rain that came, as if to find in the light that now flickered on that tomb, the sort of courage that had come to them. When there is a voice, a word, a hand that can touch that deep chord of good, which is very profoundly seated in this country, in all of its people, the cultured and the uncultured, the colored and the white, the privileged and the underprivileged, those who behave well and those who don't behave well. It's in everybody. When there is something that can touch that chord, the response is fantastic. Therefore, it is up to your generation to begin to change this trend. You must do what they do in communist countries. I'm telling you that they're using a good system for a bad purpose. That's why they're going to survive. You must train yourselves to give a portion of your life to public office. Even if this is going to be to the detriment of your ability to earn money. Money has become our God. Good men leave government because they can make more money in industry. They leave the less good to government. This is a tragedy. In a communist country, you study the meaning of government, not just as one more course of history, but how you handle public affairs, the economics of government, which are different from the economics of a person's private life or of a business. There is a study of public affairs, of public life. There is in this country one that I know of, perhaps more that I don't know of, school of public affairs and public service. The Maxwell School, which is attached to Syracuse University. This is a graduate school for people who go into top government positions. So what do they have? 50, 100 people. What's that for this land? We have 435 members of Congress and 100 senators. There's 535 people that you need who ought to have had some training. We have 50 states, therefore 50 governors, 50 lieutenant governors, 50 attorney generals in the state. On and on and on. Think of the hundreds of people in public office. But this is how you get a Mr. Wallace and his wife. This is how you get Mr. Maddox, if we're going to get him. This is how, instead, because of desire to save, you get a man like Winthrop Rockefeller in Arkansas and Nelson Rockefeller in New York. These are people who have studied the meaning of service. Every one of the Rockefellers has. He's been compelled to. I knew old man Rockefeller, and believe me, you, the discipline of those people. It might amuse you to know that old man, John D. Rockefeller Sr., whom I never knew, his granddaughter, the daughter of one of his only two daughters, lived in Florence, Italy, where I was born. Her mother died when she was a child. Her father was a professor of history. He took her to live in Italy because he was afraid that in America everybody would know she was the only granddaughter at that time of John D. Rockefeller Sr., the millions coming to her, that she would never be able to have a life. She bought a villa and she lived in Florence with a governess, and I'm telling you that I am not a Rockefeller. She didn't have much more than I did. She was about 8 or 10 years older than I am. Perhaps she was a good friend of mine. We were both staying at the beach with a mutual friend. She was about 19, well, perhaps I was 12 or 10, 11 or 12. My grandfather was an American, and he had a checkbook, something that didn't exist in Europe in common usage at all. And he used to make out checks for my mother to go to the bank or my grandmother to get cash, and I had seen him make out checks. We are sitting in the garden, Margaret Strong was this Rockefeller girl's name, and myself, and two little girls come along selling tickets for a benefit. And Margaret was very interested in this benefit, and she was a very generous person. And she said to me, "Oh, I have no money. Do you think they would take a check?" So I said, well, the little girls wouldn't take a check, they wouldn't know what it was. But I said, "I tell you what you do, make out a check, and the chauffeur of the friend with whom we were staying will go in cash." And Margaret Rockefeller Strong was going to make out a check for 100 lire, and she had never made out a check. And I taught her how. In later years, we have been together on fundraising operations for the opera in New York, and one day she turned around to me and said, "You know, I know how to write a check now." Oh, I said, "I'm so glad I taught you." But this is to say that these are people who were kept always very, very tightly. Their money was something that you used for good, you never splurged with. These men have studied government. But so they're two. There are two more available brothers. Maybe they'll come to the fore in public office also. I don't know. But what? You don't have to be a Rockefeller to run for office, except in this country we've made the business of running for office a shocking financial proposition. You cannot run for office if you're not a millionaire. And it doesn't matter where or how you got the money. That's the worst of it. Is this a democracy? What have we done with that great statement that anybody born in the United States can run for the presidency? I would have you know, woman as well as man now. What that introduced. What has become of that? You can't even run for dog catcher without enough money to buy time on television and on radio. So will you tell me what we've done with this? And I really mean this, very sincerely, that you are the generation. And the trouble with it is, because I might say here, for your information, that I was one of the instigators of the committee on youth in the International Cooperation Year of the President. Well, of course, naturally, I was the right person at my age. I'm 20, I'm blonde, blue-eyed, I'm a summer girl, I'm an ideal person, obviously. But I'm telling you that there wasn't anybody, cover girl or non-cover girl, to start this committee. And I insisted that we have one. And I insisted that there was no use in talking about international cooperation in years to come if we didn't have in our committees the people who are going to carry on what we decide. Do you know that it was never possible to get young people, even people not in college anymore, but people who were already in jobs, who were young, to take the risk of perhaps having to take it out of their summer vacation or something, to come to Washington for 2 or 3 meetings to sit on these committees, committees related to their assorted professions, science or travel or transportation or education, or any one of these. There were 22 committees. And in my committee, the Committee on Youth, it was after spending something like $50 worth of long-distance telephone calls out of my own pocket that I located the president of the Association of Student Unions, or something, his name is Joe Fallon, he's a boy from Virginia, incidentally. I forget the name of the association. He left college and he went into this organization. Incidentally, he was one of the young men at Lynchburg who heard me say this kind of thing, and he quit what he was doing and went in there to try to organize the youth. He was the only youth organization that had an experienced, capable person who could come and sit in on our committee. I'm not saying that when you are a student, you cut your classes to go to meetings of this kind if this is going to damage your school record. But I'm saying that most of these meetings are held in vacation time, and there are not many students, except those who go to religious groups. This, I must say, there is great faithfulness to this. But this fidelity should be transposed also to public affairs. You should begin to be in committees. I am glad that I've been introduced here by the young Republicans and the young Democrats. This shows that there is an interest, a live, active interest, at least in the political party. And you don't find it in many colleges. You have to begin now to train yourself to be in a position to speak. What can you do? Read. Learn to evaluate and analyze. Invite to some of your meetings, even though they're called by just you yourself. People who are in the political field, listen to people with whom you differ. Find somebody who's an extreme left-winger. Have him come here and tell you how he thinks and why he thinks the way he thinks. You'll never be able to combat something you disagree with unless you've learned it, unless you've studied it, unless you've seen it at close range. Take an interest. Because unless you, and I am telling you again as I told you yesterday, your generation, not only you begin to look back to the values of this country and try by influence and example to reinstate them in all matters, the handling of sex, of other morals, of everything else, but you must begin to train yourself for public office. Because we now never put into public office a person who is trained for it. The people who are graduates in political science, in the social sciences, in economics, in mathematics, are picked out of a teaching job in Harvard and brought, or any other one, college or university of the land that you can think of, and brought to be advisors to the president. And when the president ceases to be president for whatever reason, they go back to their teaching and they're never heard of again. And the president has around him charming people, but who have never even looked at the world outside their windows. There are not enough people who can be elected to government with this kind of preparation. And somebody has to make this sacrifice. Sure, to be in government isn't as well paid as to be in industry, or as to be in the advertising world, where you can influence the thinking of all of us, to have such violent head aches and pains that we'd all spend all our substance on some of these remedies and thereby add to their millions. Nicer to be in that profession. But in every dictatorship of the right and of the left, there are schools where the people with an interest in government, with an understanding of public affairs. Not everybody has it. Not everybody has a mathematical mind. Not everybody has a musical talent. There are people with a talent for public affairs and government. But in our country, my claim is that we stunt them. We don't give them the proper environment. In those other countries, they are selected. They are watched in high school and through college. You have a real talent for leadership. You will come and study in this school for government. Sure, in the end, what they produce is communism. That's their business. But in the end, what such training could produce is a sound, living, freedom-loving democracy. And you can't do this without training or teaching. There is a role for youth, not just the youth of the world. Much of the youth of the world has been thrown into a leading role by the accidents of history. There is a role for the youth of America to play. Because the years lying ahead are the years of the young people, of adventure, of daring, of courage, of disregard of the material ease and comfort. They are the years of going ahead for the challenge to the mind and to the spirit. And you are the young people. Thank you.
Sergio, may I express appreciation for your stimulating lectures. We have certainly enjoyed having you on our campus. Our only regret is that you cannot stay with us longer, but we hope you'll come back and see us again. Two brief announcements. Ms. Johnson informs me that Ms. Sergio's book, The Prayers of Women, will be available here at the front at a reduced price of $3. She's gotten it to me before. Secondly, Ms. Sergio has consented to remain here at the front for any of you who wish to speak to her a few moments. If you have questions you would like to pursue further with her, she'll be glad to talk to you. Thank you. We stand adjourned.